From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the early morning hours of June 28, 1969 in New York City. We're going to come back to those hours in a moment, but first, go back to 1961 when the state of Illinois repealed its anti-sodomy law. Throughout the 1950s and into the 1960s, homosexuality was essentially illegal in the United States. Illinois took a step toward changing that, but this remained a fiercely anti-gay country. 49 states still outlawed homosexuality, and the punishment for homosexuality was serious. In some states, a heavy fine, in others, imprisonment. And alongside the legal risk to being gay, there were myriad other dangers. That's why bars and clubs sprung up in places like New York City to serve as a kind of refuge. Now, one of those establishments was the Stonewall Inn. It was owned by the mafia, which bribed the police, keeping cops away sometimes. But that was hardly an act of charity and activism on behalf of the mob. Its leaders overcharged patrons to get into Stonewall. The mob extorted wealthy gay people, threatening to out them publicly. And police still showed up on occasion to arrest and charge patrons. Officers had the authority to determine what kind of clothing was appropriate based on gender, and they were not hesitant to arrest based on their own dress code. All of which leads to June 28, 1969. 9 police officers raided the Stonewall Inn, but the customers and bartenders had had enough. Many resisted. Outside the bar, the resistance grew. People gathered to protest police, some throwing bottles and trying to get past police barriers, and the cops retreated inside the bar. The ensuing public unrest lasted several days, but the impact would be permanent. In other cities, in other bars, other neighborhoods, patrons decided not to tolerate police abuse when they could. It wasn't easy, of course. Stonewall led to the creation of the Gay Liberation Front, which publicly advocated for equal rights and organized the first gay pride parade. In 2016, President Obama made the Stonewall Inn a national monument. And as we approach 50 years since Stonewall, we're talking about the history and previewing some events and some things that are taking place right here in our community. So let's welcome our guests for the hour. Jeremy Chung is an activist. We've seen him before in various settings. It's great to have you back here, Jeremy. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Adrian Elam is an activist, an artist, an entrepreneur, and organizer of Rochester Black Pride. Adrian, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
And Larry Francer is Associate Director of Preservation for the Landmark Society of Western New York. Larry, welcome back to you as well.
Great to be here. Thanks.
I want to mention that Stonewall 50 Years Out is an exhibition commemorating this anniversary. And there's an opening reception next Friday night, 6 to 9 p.m. There's going to be hors d'oeuvres, cash bar, Stonewall era music, and all sponsored in part by the Out Alliance. And so there's a lot to talk about this hour. We did reach out to Rochester City Historian, and their team there, along with the team from the Central Library of Rochester and Monroe County, have done a lot of work to put this together. Mayor Warren would not approve of someone from the city coming on this program today, but there's a lot to talk about with what they've got planned coming up. And you're going to have a chance to see the exhibit for quite a while, but the launch is next Friday night here. And the city historian was raving about Adrian Elam's work there, I have to say. can you give us a sense for what you've been working on, what people are going to see, Adrian?
So for this project, I've been working on a portrait series for members of the community. And so one of the things that I wanted to do was really take the opportunity to showcase folks. So over the course of history, you know, when people think of LGBT rights, they normally think of white gay men, and that's kind of been the narrative, that's kind of been the imagery that most people have seen. And it, in my opinion, it does a disservice to the roots of Stonewall and like who started Stonewall. So you think of Stormy, Marsha, Sylvia, the folks who were, you know, trans folks and black queer women who were the ones who began the initial resistance, and kind of the legacy of that, and how oftentimes those narratives are pushed to the margins and kind of left out. So I wanted to take this opportunity to highlight many people here who I know, who, you know, the larger community may not be familiar with, who are just living their most authentic lives and doing a lot of great work in the community. So we have about 25-26 portraits that are going to be kind of hung around the exhibit, featuring, you know, people of different ethnicities, size, ability, religion,
age.
Age, yes. Trying to get them all, you know.
Right.
And I think it's going to be a really, really powerful piece. And just and along with that, they all kind of just I got a chance to sit and talk with them and just kind of about their lives and kind of how they navigated being who they are. And, you know, as much of, you know, for a lot of folks, many of these things are rooted in like resistance or like tragedy or like things that have happened and like, you know, pushback they receive. Many of them still find ways to, all of them still find ways to, again, be authentically who they are and to find the joy in life. And so I wanted to take an opportunity to highlight many aspects of that. So whether it's people talking about, you know, where do you draw your strength from, or what does, how does your aesthetic or, you know, clothes, you know, how does that, you know, help you express yourself? Like, what are some of the quirky things that kind of people, you know, something you might be embarrassed about, but it's like it's something that makes you, one, incredibly human, but, you know, very uniquely you. And so I think what that's going to do for people who aren't of the community, really kind of see people as human beings, which is practically what everyone wants, you know?
Absolutely. And I should mention, the WXXI is a proud media sponsor here, along with City Newspaper. So, again, the launch, the opening reception, next Friday, April 5th. How long have you been working on this?
For like the past, it seems like forever, but it seems like the past month or two.
Yeah, it was really quick. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was great.
Do you have any sense of either relief or, I mean, I know there's a lot of emotion tied to a project like this, but has it been difficult as an artist to kind of get into understanding your subjects, but what they've gone through here?
No. Because many of them, you know, these are my community members, you know, these are my neighbors, these are my friends, these are my associates, coworkers, fellow conspirators, organizers, you know what I mean? So these are people that I know. And so really my job was just to kind of, you know, several of them were like, you know, they've never done a photo shoot before. This was their first one. And so my job was just to create a safe space for them to be themselves. And then we just had a conversation. So in my mind, it was a lot more simple than, you know, that's the part of my job I love to do, where I can just kind of sit and really peek behind the curtain of someone else's life and just listen.
Have you seen them?
Yeah, we got a preview yesterday, and they are
gorgeous.
Fabulous.
It's a shame this is radio, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah, just the expressions and the color, and it's really just beautiful. When we were looking at putting the exhibit together, there's a big back wall that we had to design. And we decided we would put a couple of videos running, one that is sort of specifically about President Obama making Stonewall a National Historic Monument, the first, the only LGBTQ monument. And the other one is more specifically about the Stonewall Uprising. And then we wanted to do portraits. And we had a lot of discussion about who the portraits would be of. Would they be of members of the community that people knew? Mm-hmm. And we decided that's not what we wanted. We didn't want a very familiar face that everybody hears on the radio, mm-hmm. you know, talking about the LGBTQ community. We wanted the people who are just living the life. And when Adrian said that he would be willing to do it, we were really excited.
I think that's an interesting approach. And I think, you know, I was just talking to students at a local school district, Adrian, about, you know, their perceptions. We're working on a number of stories about how especially suburban districts handle Black History Month, for example. Mm-hmm. And some of the frustration of students is, well, it's the same 3 to 5 names always mentioned. Not to say that the civil rights leaders of this country ought, you know, not be known, of course, but it starts to feel a little cliche and limited, and there's so much beyond that, even in Black History Month. And then I wonder if that's sort of a similar approach that you have here, that there's power and stories well beyond what we would sort of typically maybe narrowly, especially, you know, someone in my life perspective, know of.
I mean, yeah, so, you know, you sit and you, I mean, anytime that you sit down and you kind of talk to people, depending on who you're talking to, they bring a different perspective and just kind of wealth of knowledge about anything. And so many folks, you know, the places they've gone or the things that they've been through, I'm just like, wow, I didn't know like that was a thing. Or like, you know, my aunties, Marion and Judith, who they've been married for, again, what seems like forever. And they were talking about just like the rich history of like the Black lesbian community here and like the different spaces that they had and like the social groups that they had. And I'm like, wait, what? And like these are, you know, kind of, and I'm sure we'll get into this later about like oral history and like these things have just been kind of lost over time. In term, particularly with like Black and Brown communities, so it's like these stories are lost, particularly because of, you know, like HIV/AIDS epidemic and the crack epidemic and, you know, racism always, and like just the disparities that people face, and like those stories just kind of get lost. And so it's, for me, again, it's an honor to kind of, again, make space for people to just tell those stories and kind of see the things that I don't know about or that I know other people aren't necessarily aware of, and kind of make sure those get elevated to the surface.
Jeremy, let's talk a little bit about history here before we kind of talk even more about some of these various layers. And I think Adrian's making an important point about whose story is included, whose story is told and is not told, and what happens over time. But when it comes to the actual history itself, you know, you and I have talked about your own sort of life path and how what has moved and changed you over time. What do you remember growing up learning about Stonewall? Do you remember the first time learning about it? Because for me, it was not in school, for sure.
No,
absolutely. And I don't know how well schools are sort of grappling with that or teaching it at all, but not in school for you either?
No. I mean, I moved to New York in 1984 and probably learned it through osmosis. There was no formal, but that, I don't want to denigrate the osmosis project or process of it, because the oral histories and the mentorship of older gay men to younger gay men that I experienced, that was how I learned it. And the reason that there is this big gap in people's knowledge of Stonewall is because we lost a whole generation mm-hmm. of mentors who could have been passing down that information. I was lucky enough to arrive in New York in 84 and receive all of that.
But were you maybe surprised that you didn't know at the time? And I ask this because, you know, now we're having, I think, we are slowly starting to have conversations about a wide range of issues, whether it's sort of a white or Eurocentric approach to just history in general, you know, the way, whether Black History Month, gay liberation. I don't know if Stonewall's being taught, but now it's a national monument. At the very least, you would think that opens the door to see a little bit more. It shouldn't just be oral histories, I guess is what I'm saying, right?
That's true. As a man without children, I'm not sure what's being taught in the education system right now. Somebody who's more familiar with that is probably better equipped to speak about it. I would hope that everybody, you know, that the Stonewall is being taught as part of the history of America.
Yeah. What do you think, Larry?
Well, I think that has a lot to do with this exhibit and the fact that, you know, with 50 years out from the uprising, there are a lot of places. Jeremy, you went to the one at the Public Library in New York, right?
Yes.
And I think the fact that there a lot of the exhibits are being done in libraries is making it much more accessible to so many people. And I've absolutely got to give a shout out to Christine Radarsky mm-hmm. and Michelle Finn and Brandon Fess and all the folks from the library and the city historian's office who have just been working really, really hard this exhibit. And I don't know if I should share, but I will share that we're actually opening the exhibit a month later than we had originally planned because it was really a process getting the right people at the table and enough people at the table with different perspectives. Adrian, it took a while for you to join the table.
Yeah.
And no, I'm not blaming you. I'm
saying
it was a lot of it was our fault not having the connections and finding the people and, you know, the different age groups. And this was a very involved process. Mm-hmm. Because it wasn't just telling the story of Stonewall, right, which is really a very small part of it. It's really telling the story of the journey of the LGBTQ community from that point on, and very specifically in Rochester and this area. So yeah. It's been really exciting for me to be working with all these people. And, you know, I'm not a historian. You know, I'm a preservationist, and there's a big difference. But sitting with this table of many historians was just amazing. And if I don't say Evelyn Bailey, you know, I don't know what's going to happen to me. I'll be struck down, because Evelyn
is an encyclopedia.
She's amazing.
Yeah, amazing.
And she was such a great resource on putting this together.
So I've been mentioning next Friday, but let's just make sure you know when you can see it. So well beyond next Friday. So Larry,
it opens April 5th, and it's going through July 20th. Christine was actually able to push it a little longer and to get it to go through Pride, which is really wonderful. Yeah. And during Pride, we're going to be doing another historic walking tour. Evelyn is putting that together. And through the library, we're also doing a lunchtime tour. We're doing one May 23rd, a historic walking tour, an LGBTQ walking tour. And we're looking at a date, maybe the beginning of July as well. The 12 o'clock time works really well, we found. We have a architecture for lunch that Cynthia Hauck does, and she always gets tons of people there. So we're going to try that time frame.
But you got plenty of time starting next Friday through July 20th to get to Stonewall 50 Years Out. Where do people need to go, Larry?
It's the Anthony Mascioli, I hope I said that right, Mascioli?
Yeah, it must be.
Gallery, which is the Central Library, Hacker Hall, first floor, Rundell Memorial Building. Yeah. It's the beautiful historic building that was recently restored, that whole area. It's gorgeous. Mm-hmm. And
all right. I'm going to grab a phone call, and then we're going to we've got a lot of different places we need to go in this conversation. But Don in East Rochester has been waiting. So go ahead, Don.
Good afternoon. I'm really glad to hear about this exhibit, and I really plan on going to see it. Perhaps I'll be there at the opening, perhaps not, but I really want to see this, and I really would like to thank the people that have curated this and who have put this together. It's an incredible, it sounds like an incredible contribution to our community. But one thing that bothers me about the community today is that it seems, if I could put it in one phrase, it would be creeping assimilationism. And what I find problematic about something like that is that we've made tremendous progress in the past 50 years, no doubt about that. But I think one of the things we are losing is we are losing the uniqueness of our community for the idea that, we just need to assimilate into the general community. To me, I find that a bit abhorrent, because I think we are so unique and that we are so beautiful, you might say, that we should be proud of our distinctiveness and resist assimilation as much as possible. One of the things that really bothers me is that we take the term gay or LGBTQ out of common descriptions, like the Pride Parade. To call it the Pride Parade only and not the Gay Pride Parade or the LGBTQ Pride Parade is like saying that Black History Month is just History Month. That's not true. And it's not just any old Pride Parade. It is a Gay Pride Parade. I find this to be bothersome.
Okay. All right. Well, Don, I appreciate the perspective. Let's go around the table. I'll start with Adrian. What do you think?
I don't really know why they changed it from Gay Pride, but from what I'm hearing, even still, is the term gay. It's for a long time, that's just kind of been the blanket kind of term that everyone has used, and that's just to assume that, again, we're just talking about and most people, when they think gay, they think of two men coming together. You completely kind of erase gender in that, the many different identities around these things. And so I think Pride was intended to be more of an all-inclusive, encompassing term from everyone on the LGBTQ AI spectrum, you know. And I think even with all the work that has been done, I've been very critical of marriage equality in terms of where it ranks on where the larger community should be focused. At the same time, it's like, again, it's the same thing that many groups, women, black people, everyone's fighting for, which is, again, the right to be treated equally, specifically equally under the law as full-on human beings, having the same rights regardless of race, gender, sexuality, any of these things. And I think that's part of, again, that's the root of what people want. I do agree that, you know, and I think it'll be shown in the exhibit, like there are many things in the community that are unique to our community. So we talk about ballroom culture, like leather culture, like different bar cultures, like all these different things, how people represent it in terms of family. So you have like chosen family narratives and like a whole bunch of other things that are going on. And we, you know, that is unique to the culture. And again, it's about who's telling this story. So, you know, who are people learning about these things? Do people know about these things? And how are these things highlighted and things like that? So again, if you come to see the exhibit, I think you'll see it has a nice, it's not like all encompassing, but you know, it has a nice, it's a great starting place for people to get more curious about LGBTQ community as a community and culture. So.
Okay. Jeremy, what do you make of his comments on assimilation?
I think that I'm not going to call it a bell curve because I'm not sure what the shape of the curve is, but we're definitely in a period of assimilation that I think is necessary. And if we look at, I don't want to get too political, but if we look at Pete Buttigieg, who seems to be lauded for his accomplishments, someday I hope we're at the point where he'll be lauded for his queerness as well. Because right now the conversation seems to be, he's great and you don't even notice he's gay. And I don't like that tone. I would prefer that his queerness be embraced as the full 360-degree part of him.
No, just, and I'm before I turn to Larry on this, just kind of follow up on Buttigieg. Who was the guest the other day? Who was it, Megan Mack? Peterson Toscano, who was in town, who is an activist and a theatrical performer who happens to be gay. He calls himself a quaint queer or quirky queer Quaker is his own description, and he does some really interesting educational work on climate change. But on Buttigieg, what he said was, you know, he said, I'm happy in some ways that to see strides, progress in different ways, but he's still a safe gay guy. You know, it's a white guy who was a veteran, he was in the military, and he's, you know, pretty stereotypically a white, you know, male gay person with sort of a masculine-ish tone.
Like cisgender, mm-hmm. Okay.
And so from Peterson's perspective, small step, but not like the only step here.
Absolutely.
So let's not oversell it.
We're somewhere on the bell curve. I'm not sure where we are, and we probably won't know where we are
until
we're looking backward at it. But I think, not to diminish at all his contributions, but the conversations that I'm hearing about him seem to not be talking about his gayness at all. And I'd like to be able to have a kind of candidate someday where we can celebrate that as much as we can celebrate any other aspect of their personality.
Okay, Larry?
Yeah, I'm in full agreement with both of you. And I really like the point that the caller was making because I've heard in the community, I mean, the Landmark Society was looking at putting a sort of, you know, we've got the YUPS, the Young Urban Preservationists, and doing like the GUPS, the Gay Urban Preservationists, or something like that. And I got some pushback. I did. They were like, you know, why do we want to call attention to ourselves? Well, I really think we should be celebrating who we are. And I think this exhibit does that. And I was very happy to hear the call.
Yeah, okay.
This is where I kind of have to, this is kind of where intersectionality kind of comes into play. Because again, there are certain people of the community who have that same narrative and they've had that same kind of concern of like, why do we have to call attention to ourselves versus folks who have almost no choice but to have tension be a call to themselves, right? So I think a lot about like our amazing trans community here. And I'm just here and everywhere. And it's like, you know, they're, again, living their fullest, most authentic lives. And they have no choice but to call attention to themselves. Like that whole, them being themselves garners attention. And not the attention that, you would, you know, would want. You know what I mean? A lot of the times. And so I think, I just think, again, it has a lot to do with, again, whose stories we're really looking at, mm-hmm. and who's able to tell those stories and who we're kind of centering or not. in kind of where, because again, at the same time, I look at Ryan Murphy's show Pose, like with the all black trans cast and centering trans narratives. It's a show on FX. Their second season is coming up this summer. And again, it's focused specifically in like ballroom culture, which is now like a lot more mainstream now. But again, that is centrally something that has been crucial and like a mainstay in the black LGBTQ community and the black and brown community. And so like those kind of things and those kind of stories, like that's the kind of stuff I want to see on TV. So I want to see more stories like that on TV, in magazines and things like that. And so that's where I kind of assimilation, if you have it, and I kind of look at it more so like, again, having people at the table and making sure people are listening and that their voices hold weight and those and they can be centered while at the table.
All right, listeners, if you want to join the conversation, you can email connections@wxxi.org. You can call the program 844-295-TALK, as Don did from East Rochester. We're talking about Stonewall 50 Years Out, which is an exhibition commemorating the anniversary of the uprising that sparked the gay liberation movement. And it also explores the history and the current reality of Rochester's LGBTQ plus communities. So the opening is next Friday, April 5th. At 6 p.m., 6 to 9 is the opening reception at Rundell Library, Larry Francis, mm-hmm, right?
Correct. I mean,
among other important distinctions on names of individual rooms, go to Rundell.
Right, go to Rundell.
And then you've got through July 20th to do that. So after our only break of the hour, we're going to talk about, you know, whose story is and is not included, and some of what Adrian Elam's work does is exactly, I think, with that in mind. And we're going to talk about some other efforts to bring out stories, history, photos, coming out stories, what's being collected and where. Jeremy will have things to tell us there. A lot more to talk about as we talk about Stonewall 50 Years Out here on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, our guest is Larry Blumenfeld, the jazz critic for the Wall Street Journal. He's in upstate New York this week, sharing his work with college students and his writing and research centering lately especially on the intersection of music and social justice. He joins us for the hour to discuss a range of issues including jazz in troubled times. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. There's a lot of ways that you can sort of interact and see what's coming up here with Stonewall 50 Years Out. And Jeremy Chung, I know there's an effort to collect some history, some photos, whether it's coming out stories. What's going on there?
Well, that's basically how I got involved in the project, is I heard that there was a gathering of oral histories. So I kind of I cornered Evelyn Bailey when I saw her. I said, how can I get involved? There's an app called PicStory, mm-hmm. and we're not only are we gathering oral histories, but the app allows us to link those with an image. So we're going out into the community and trying to gather as many oral histories as we can so that we can tell the broadest possible story about the LGBTQ experience here in Rochester. Mm-hmm. It's a great way to link people's memories with a specific image. There will be PicStory gathering dates at the exhibit. So if you want to react to something you've seen in the show, there will be specific dates where you can actually record your PicStory there. I'm actually going out into the community at the Out Alliance, at the JCC. The Gay Men's Chorus has been kind enough to sing for us and sing their memories. And if anybody actually has stories that they would like to tell, you can just call Michelle Finn at the library. And she's allowed us to give her telephone number.
I'm going to say, did you ask her about that?
she did. This is it. You can get in more information actually at ffrpl.org on the actual show. And if you would like to share your story, you can contact Michelle Finn at 585-428-8368.
Okay. And you'll be able to hear those stories and see those pictures at the exhibit, where mm-hmm. we've got an area set up for people to check out what's already on there before they put their stories on too.
Yeah, and Jeremy, I guess this really is a question for everybody, but you know, when you collect these stories, I want to ask you who they are for. I mean, I guess they're for everybody, but what I'm thinking about is, you know, even a short time ago when I was in high school, you know, 304 graduates in my high school, probably knew two out gay people. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that long ago. Now you go back to class reunions, and there's several dozen, and people from, you know, it's just not what it was before. And I go back to my high school, which I'm have all kinds of issues with, but I at least think it is different in the sense that being out is not as taboo as it used to be. I am not saying it's easy, or I'm not saying there's no discrimination, or especially, I think, as to Adrian's point, intersectionally, more difficult in different spaces than others. Mm-hmm. But I am wondering if sharing more of these histories helps continue to move us in a direction of whatever progress it looks like. Is that, what in your mind are the stories really aimed at?
Absolutely. I mean, visibility is the key. It's always been the key. That was the point of Stonewall, is visibility and recognition. And I know that, you know, Rochester having such a rich history in social justice, it gives me great hope every time I talk to people who are younger than myself, that they have the language to talk about things like gender. They have the language to talk about things that weren't even discussed. So if this exhibition can start conversations about the gay experience, we're encouraging, because sometimes people are shy and they don't know what to say. And I'm saying we can start with a coming out story, and then maybe we tell a story or a memory that you would like to live, or you would like to live on after you, because these will be hopefully hosted on the library website after the exhibition is over. But it's about talking about your ancestry and your legacy is probably the easiest starting point to talk about it, to make sure that these stories are heard.
And it's not just LGBTQ stories. I mean, we want everybody's stories. And we're also not trying to out anybody. So you don't have to put a picture up, and you don't have to say anything more than what you want to say and what you feel. I'm really excited to start hearing them.
Adrian, how do you feel about, what those histories, if they move us in any sense of progress? And are you feeling and sensing change in that direction?
So, well, I know for a fact that, like, the school system is still completely homophobic. So, like, I know that LGBT history really isn't taught in the way that it needs to be or it should be. I know a couple of schools have, like, gay straight alliances and things like that. But then, those have their issues and things. But, I do a lot of the work for and with the youth a lot. And so I'm always thinking about and trying to be conscious about kind of where their standpoint is. And, just being young, being like a teenager and, social pressures, peer pressures, all these other things, and then layering all these other things on top of it. And so I know even for like me and a lot of my friends, you think about being isolated and like, even though, it's being more widely accepted, quote unquote, or more visible, I should say, suicide rates are still high. Even here, representation still isn't where it needs to be. And I think, again, for like this exhibit and even like stories like these, a lot of times when I do my work, activist work, and my artistry, I think where I draw strength from is knowing where I come from, knowing my like Black history, knowing my Black queer history, and kind of like, oh, I'm not the first, I'm not the first person to, be a filmmaker and do this, or I'm not the first photographer who was Black and queer and this and that. And, I'm not the first person to deal with these things. And even thinking about Stonewall in terms of like resistance and like how I do have a right to be here and a right to express myself. Opposition, it's always going to be a thing. But how can we deal with these things and kind of, the ideas that we are stronger together, and making sure people take pride in themselves. Like last year, me and my mentee, we actually, his coming out process was he and I working on a short film together about his story. And through that whole process, you watch him, like I got to watch him grow and change and like become more comfortable with himself. And then seeing his story on screen, like the change, and now he's out and proud and doing all these other things, which is incredible. But even what it's gonna do for the kids coming behind him in terms of being proud of who he is and learning what that process is, and even though it's hard and stuff, still pushing to do that, because there's honestly no other choice. It's living a lie or being who you are.
Well, on that note, I remember seeing, and again, I don't know if Hollywood's a great source for history, but I did see the film Milk, and I thought, surprised that I liked Sean Penn in that role. But there's scenes in the film that I think are probably at least drawn with somewhat historical accuracy. At least there was an opinion among some, whether it was Harvey Milk or others, in San Francisco in those times, what, the 70s, late 70s, saying, you know, talking to people, saying, we need you to come out. Like, we have to do this. We have to show the world that this is real and this is common and these are your brothers and sisters and coworkers, et cetera. And I found myself thinking, like, well, first of all, like, you know, straight white guy, I've never had a risk like that. Thinking, like, well, if I just live as myself, I'm going to endanger my job or my life or my family. It's easy for me to be like, yeah, you know, we need, come on out. But like, that's not really my conversation to have. That's sort of like, stay out of it. But I am curious to know if you find that fraught or if you have any, you know, sense for the importance of, even if it's carrying risk, living authentically for someone who is young, scared, still worried about that.
Because a lot of people don't, some people just don't have choices. You know, and it's about who has the choice to come out and who does, you know. And so, again, we talk about intersectionality. And so, like, you know, some folks, in it, you know, being in the closet or not being able to live as authentically as you are has ramifications one way or the other. So whether you might get to keep your job, but internally, what is that? Internally, spiritually, mentally, like, those have ramifications of you. I've seen people go through so many different orchestrations and hoops to, like, just meet up with someone for a date and then, like, all the steps and doing this to do that and go back and this so no one, quote unquote, knows. I remember the stunts I used to pull in high school, middle school to, you know, live my best life. There we go. And it's just, like, it's exhausting. And again, I had the, even myself, I had the privilege to kind of have a process like that. Others did not. Some people, you can't hide these things, or, you know, it's about, I feel, you know, I feel like I'm born in the wrong body, and, like, what do you do with that? And then, you know, I like to wear these kind of clothes, and then people are just putting things on me, or they just are looking at me or treating me a certain kind of way, and I can't help who I am. Again, being black, I can't help that. I walk outside, people just, they put whatever they want to on me, and it's like, well, I look at it as, I'm damned if I do, I'm damned if I don't, so I might as well do, because this is my life at the end of the day, and I'd be damned if I'm not going to be happy.
Jeremy, how do you feel about that?
Well, hard to follow. Such a wonderful, wonderful expression. I was really lucky enough to dig into the Out Alliance archives of photographs from the old empty closets, and I've discovered so many significant photographs of activist demonstrations here in the Rochester area. One of them, in Queer Nation, I'm not sure of the date, but I believe it was in the late 90s, on one of the 490 overpasses hung a giant sheet that said, come out, as I'm sure as a response to the AIDS crisis. But we know that visibility is attention, attention is funding, and if funding helps everybody. But I was really impressed by the amount of early activist activity here in the Rochester area, which we'll be including in the exhibit as well.
Wow. Larry?
Well, growing up in the 60s and 70s was a lot different than it is now. I mean, as simply as when Will and Grace first was on TV. Growing up, I could never, ever imagine that something like that would happen, that there would be a gay character on TV. So everybody knew I was gay. I'm not sure I knew exactly what gay was or that I was gay, but I knew I was different. And back in the, you know, the late 60s and early 70s, it was not easy to come out. So, you know, I went off to college and that's when I came out. But it was a very different time. And it was a very different time because that was pre-HIV/AIDS. So that was another really important thing that we wanted to make sure we got into this exhibit. The joy of the gay community. I mean, mostly it was the white gay men that, you know, had the joy of the bars and the clubs and the bathhouses. I mean, I really pushed, and I only pushed at the beginning, and I was really pleased to see yesterday at our meeting that there's a picture of Bette Midler at the Continental Baths when she was performing. And I think that's something that we do need to celebrate.
When you were in college, was it any easier? Did you feel?
It was very easy. I mean, I went to Wesleyan University, and it was a very open college. It was very, very easy to come out in college. And then I lived in New York City during my junior year of college, and I mean, that was just crazy, fabulous, and crazy gay, and it was a great life. It was really wonderful.
Do you look at what happened in the 1980s with the AIDS epidemic as this is where I think history gets a little bit too abbreviated, and you know, probably also gets a little centered on identity and not others. Was there momentum in the late 70s that felt like it was halted because of AIDS?
Oh, sure.
Yeah?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I mean, there was all that fear within the community as well as outside of the community. And, you know, there was just a real political backlash. And, yeah, it was tough. And I would think coming out around that time probably was more difficult.
I think it also provided a sense of urgency, though, because our lives depended on it.
Mm-hmm.
So there were two sides.
Yeah.
And now, as we look at history, I want to return to the theme of making sure stories are told. Gay history, mm-hmm. but also all of the layers of gay history.
Right.
How do we... you know, kind of go forward. I mean, you're doing your part now in amazing ways here, Adrian. How do we tell stories that include more voices, more people?
I find the best way often to do that is sometimes, actually a lot of the time, is just doing your best to create space and kind of getting out the way and allowing people to, again, share their experiences, share their stories, and being open to listening to what that sounds like, what that looks like, and having the willingness to accept a couple things. Like, one, you don't know everything, and the willingness to accept that your perspective does not somehow outweigh another person's. And so, like, even what we do with Black Pride, I'm the person who raises the money. And I allow other people to kind of express their ideas. I don't agree with everything. They might like some different kind of music that I like, and I'm like, I don't really want to do that, but it's not about me. It's about, again, I think, how can we make space and how can we create safety for people to be themselves, especially in our community when we know outside of our community that's not, safety is not a guarantee for everyone. And so within our community, how can we create spaces and, again, center those voices who we often do not see and we don't hear? I've heard that the typical Netflix is, if you look on, like, Netflix and, like, you look at their LGBT section, it's nothing but just, like, pretty much white gay stories outside of, like, maybe, like, three of them. And so when we think, again, so within that, it's like, whose stories aren't being told? Who don't I see here? Where are the stories about women? Where are the stories about trans women, trans folks, gender nonconforming folks? Where are the folks about the queer Mexican community, the queer Black community, the queer Puerto Rican community, the queer Haitian community, the queer Asian community? Like, where are these stories? Who are these folks? And how can we make space for them to tell their stories?
And so on that note, in our remaining minutes, let's close as we opened, as we're talking 50 years out from Stonewall. That's the name of the upcoming exhibition, Stonewall 50 Years Out, an exhibition commemorating the anniversary of the uprising that sparked the gay liberation movement, also exploring Rochester's LGBTQ+ mm-hmm. communities and their history. Opening reception is next Friday, April 5th, from 6 to 9 at Rundell Library, and you can see the exhibition through July 20th. So there's a lot going on, and there will be different events as our guests have been telling you about here. But Stonewall itself, it's interesting that Stonewall is now sort of viewed, the president in 2016, President Obama, making it a national monument, it wasn't just a white gay bar. I mean, so let's make sure we understand a little bit of the history, maybe what happened that night and those ensuing days and what it means now to you, Adrian.
The folks who, without the black and brown trans community, there would be no Stonewall riots, there would be no Stonewall uprising. It's the folks. I think it's important to understand like the intersection of being black, being queer, being trans, and then the fact that that fight was against police around the same time that, again, the larger civil rights movement was combating police brutality and racism, and kind of the synergy that was happening. Because even once the gay liberation movement started, even the Black Panthers were supportive of the movement and said, you know, they recognized the idea that our liberation is very much tied to theirs and vice versa. And so, again, I think over the course of time, those folks who had started, because I remember there was a movie that came out like 3 years ago where they really tried to center some gay white boys, like the starter of Stonewall, and I was like, y'all are doing a lot. That's Hollywood. But I think it's important to recenter those stories and those folks who, without whom, the gay liberation movement would not be in existence. And even still today, even in this community, there are so many, particularly black trans women who are my dear friends, who are putting in so much incredible work in this community, and they do it without thanks, and a lot of time they go unnoticed. And again, it's important to center those folks and those stories and their experiences and making sure we're supporting them.
Jeremy, I can't imagine what it must have been like, and I'll never have that experience in the summer of 1969, when the patrons at Stonewall, some of the bartenders decided that's it. Like, police don't just get to come here and say, we're arresting a trans woman because of dress. We're arresting this. We're arresting for gay acts or suspicion. That's a lot of courage, knowing what could come your way.
I think going back to Don's call, I think it's important for everybody to remember that Stonewall was a riot, not a parade. And as we kind of reflect back on the last 50 years of the movement, we need to know that it started with civil disobedience and a reaction against oppression. We need to capture the rage, but we also need to capture the joy of the community. But we can't forget the rage in the celebration of this. It's also a commemoration of lives lost and battles fought.
Mm-hmm. Larry, some thoughts on Stonewall then.
I really think it's a great deal of it is about respect and not toleration, looking at your jacket you wore today, Jeremy. I hate when people just say, we'll live with it or we'll tolerate it. But what we have always demanded, or what at least Stonewall demanded, was respect. And I think we need to stick with that.
It's an important distinction, I think, this notion of, we've achieved some level of tolerance. It's not the same as wanting true equality of opportunity. I don't think. I don't know that we ever get to where we sort of want to go in the collective sentiment of this table if our goal is just to get people to tolerate. Yeah? Do you agree, Adrian?
Yeah, I'm not a fan of toleration. Like, I prefer to spend, there's a quote somewhere, it's like, I prefer to go to spaces where I'm celebrated, not just tolerated. And again, you have many folks in the communities have created those spaces where they can celebrate one another, the ballroom community in one particular sense. But, again, and to Jeremy's point, like, Stonewall was not a riot. A lot of how we got anything that we had.
Not a parade, yeah.
It was not a parade. These were riots. These were resistance against particularly the police, particularly against oppressive forces. And, again, those fights are still happening. I think, and one of the distinctions I do want to make, too, is, like, even, like, the Black Lives Matter movement, many of the folks who were organizing on the ground all over this country were queer and trans. And people don't really, I don't think, draw those connections. And it's like that, in my mind, is continuing that legacy of Stonewall and, like, civil rights and a whole bunch of other things. But again, who's usually at the center of these things on the ground resisting that provides the momentum for actual change to happen? It's the same folks like Marsha, like Stormy, like Sylvia.
I want to thank our guests for being here, and you can see so much coming up with Stonewall 50 years out. And I will say again, they have all said it, but I'll say again our thanks to Christine Radarsky,
yes,
from the city of Rochester, and among so many other names.
Right?
Here.
Could I do the Tony Award winning acceptance speech?
Oh man, don't leave anything
we
out.
We want to thank, and hopefully, of course, Christine, Adrian, Ralph Carter, Michelle Finn, Brandon Fess, Larry Champeau, Susan David, Miss Ricky, Justin Hubble, Jamie Spiller, Miranda Mimes, Evelyn Bailey, the Central Library of Rochester and Monroe County. Make sure we get SUNY Brockport in there, RIT, U of R, the Out Alliance, the Landmark Society, the Presbytery of Genesee Valley, Third Presbyterian Church. I think I'm getting most everybody in there.
Christopher Goodwin, the Mocha Center, Trillium Health.
Please keep going, Dr. keep Valentine. Going, guys. Yeah.
Okay. All right. I want to thank, and WXXI and City Newspaper, full disclosure, proud media sponsors.
Thanks Trillium,
to,
too.
Thanks to all of you. Larry, Jeremy, Adrian, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so
Short
much.
Break, more connections coming us. Up.